Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Kentertained? Today is July 31st. We are like a little more than 2.5 hours away from the hot-ass month of August. It's a Monday. There was no pay-per-view, but there was a Game of Thrones, and it was a very memorable one. So, Chris decided he would return. Raylene told me to go fuck myself. Chris, how are you doing?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm good. Just finished rewatching the episode, so hopefully I'll remember and retain a few things. So, feeling good about it. As much as I liked episode 2, like, every episode's becoming my new favorite episode of the season. How are you feeling about that?
There are definitely good things so far about each episode, and this one was almost a step back in terms of action, though, in regards to the difference that we talked about between episode 1 and episode 2. Episode 1 was a lot of exposition, setting the scene for where the whole season's going to be, and episode 2 is, all right, now let's push everything forward. Episode 3 had a lot of memorable moments, but at the same time, it also had a lot of, okay, this is just a conversation, here's just another conversation, here's just a conversation. So.
Yeah, they took up a lot of time with the Jon and Daenerys thing, and understandably, we haven't seen those two characters on the same screen. Everybody had a fucking virtual heart on, apparently. I didn't think it was all that wowing. Who do you feel got the better end of their little verbal sparring between Daenerys and Jon?
Oh, definitely Daenerys. I mean, who had his boat stolen?
Fair enough. I think Jon had got the upper hand, because Daenerys, like, she had a lot of good lines, but at the end of the day, it was kind of like a dude who is wooing a girl and he keeps trying to get laid, but she keeps saying no. Jon just kept saying no. Like, he's like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm not bending at the knee. And he kind of shut her the fuck down to the point where she's willing to let him mine for nothing. Nothing. Everything's free. So I was like, yeah, Daenerys, you're just kind of, I don't know. I feel that they're painting Daenerys in a weak manner. And it's like a perfect contrast to how all of a sudden Cersei is just a fucking boss, right?
I would say less that they're painting her in a weak manner and more in just that, like, when has she ever not been in either A, some position of weakness where she, think about it. She hasn't been in a position of weakness really since season 2. She's had her dragons in season 3. She got her army. For as much as she possibly could have been in a position of weakness when she was in the Dos Dothrak, the capital of the Dothraki. I mean, she went and showed them who the fuck she was. But when has she ever really had to negotiate with, you know, somebody on her level?
Yeah, I would say probably the last time she quote-unquote negotiated was with the Masters in Slaver's Bay. And before that, I'm having a hard time remembering probably, like, I don't know, right around the time that she got, Dario there. Like, there was that first meeting, there was, like, isn't that, like, when she got Missandei?
She got them from, I want to say the slavers, too, because she was the one who was translating for her when she didn't reveal that she was actually speaking the language that the dude was fucking speaking to Missandei in.
Gotcha.
So when she had the dragon burn him, and she got, you know, Grey Worm and all the Unsullied, she got Missandei, too. But, I mean, even when she was negotiating with the Masters from Astapor, I mean, she wasn't... They weren't, like, nobility, if you know what I mean. She didn't afford them the same kind of courtesies that she would be affording, you know, the nobles that, you know, hey, here, I'm going to try to make you the Warden of the North, so you're going to be one of my fucking number one henchmen. No, Yeah. Everybody's always...
Right.
Everybody since she's become the Mother of Dragons has always been saying yes, 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 yes. Or... Well, we could do that way, but maybe we should do it this way. Not straight up no. I mean, when was the last time she got a no?
Probably, like, from her brother in season one before he got his ass handed to him. Like, that's probably legitimately the last time somebody really kind of, like, gave her a firm no that did it. You know? And the point that time she was kind of a, you know, she was, what was that, episode two, three?
Yeah, I mean, he got his... You know, crown within the first five episodes, six episodes. So it's been a long time since anybody's been like that. Now, don't get me wrong, I think John definitely came off as the more level-headed, the one who's actually, he's not saying, hey, I'm going to go to war with you, or hey, I'm going to rebel against you. He's like saying, hey, it doesn't fucking matter. Our priorities need to be here. You're like looking down there. We got to be up here. Otherwise, who cares who's on this throne? Everybody else is going to be dead.
Yeah, John has become the voice of reason, and I guess that's actually part of the reason why I will always be on John's side over Daenerys' side. Daenerys is just doing this so she can regain a throne, and yeah, she's trying to be nice for people and stuff, but the crux of it all is she's trying to reclaim a throne, and people just kind of like overlook that. They're like, oh, she's such a nice person, and she has dragons, and she's lovable. The reality is, she's really not that much better than Cersei in a lot of ways, but both are very power-hungry bitches. My opinion. I know Daenerys is more likable, but I don't know. I'm really starting to like the hell out of Cersei, so...
It's like what John said in their discussion, you know, yeah, our ancestors swore loyalty to you, but then your fucking dad went crazy and burned the shit out of everybody who fucking swore loyalty. He broke loyalty first. So if that is your only claim to the Iron Throne, why should anybody fucking honor it?
Well, this whole ideology of claim to the throne, it's like... Well, who has the rightful claim? Like, seriously, I want something in writing telling me who actually has the rightful claim. Is it actually... I'm gonna guess it's Gendry in the most technical of terms. Like, but I don't know. I don't know if Daenerys technically outranks him because she was a Targaryen. Like,
okay, so... So I wanted to go back to this, if you don't mind. The interruption, because
sure.
My mom was laughing at her ass off when I was trying to remember what the Seven Kingdoms were. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't have a fucking book in front of me, Mom. Thanks a lot. So I went and researched that. So to go back to answer last week's question, the Seven Kingdoms, there was the North in Winterfell. Originally, when Aegon invaded with the dragons, and they called them the Seven Kingdoms, because there's actually like eight or nine now, it was the Iron Islands and the Riverlands were one kingdom. So the Greyjoys and the Tullys and all those, they were all part of the same kingdom. There was the Eyrie and the Vale. That was what that area was called. The Lannisters were rulers of Casterly Rock in the Western Lands. The Baratheons were ruler of the Stormlands out of Storm's End. There was Highgarden, and then there was Dorne.
Wait, where's that? Where's Storm's End?
Have we seen
it in the show?
We have never seen it in the show. So it's just one of the areas that we've never seen. But that was where a lot of the battles were fought between, like, Robert and Daenerys' family. Like, I want to say...
During the Robert's Rebellion?
During the Rebellion, yeah. They fought, like, the big one that Ned and Robert were talking about in the very first or second episode when they were sitting there talking about some of the battles that they'd been in. Was one of the ones where Robert killed whoever it was on the Trident, which is part of the Stormlands.
Okay. Now, where was it where the tower was? Lyanna giving birth to presumably Jon Snow. Where was that territory?
I don't remember. I don't even remember where the Tower of Dawn was. I would have to see the actual map, which I haven't seen in a while since I don't have any of the books handy with me right now. To go back to your first question before I interrupted that, though, it would depend on whether or not you see Robert's uprising as a rebellion and treason, and the Targaryen still as the rightful rulers, or if you see the Baratheons as the rulers since they took over. Either way, Gendry technically wouldn't be in the running because he's a bastard. Robert never even knew he was alive, so he never could acknowledge him. So it would be the same thing, like Jon Snow isn't really being the King of the North because of being, you know, Ned's son. He's the King of the North because everybody kind of voted him to be the one in charge.
It's like the North all of a sudden kind of became almost borderline democratic in a lot of ways. They kind of just said, fuck it, right?
Well, I mean, if you remember, one of the reasons Ned actually became the Hand in the beginning was because the North had been ignored for basically the entire portion of Robert's reign. So they needed money, they needed help, they needed people to man the garrisons, they needed food, you know, because they knew the winter was coming. That's the one thing that the Starks were good for. They knew the winter was coming.
Yeah, the Starks always seem to kind of have a plan. They followed through. They're a reliable thing. Like how many generations back does it go? Like, has it always been the Starks? Do we know?
The Starks have been the Wardens of the North since Daenerys' family took over when they invaded into Westeros. So, yeah, we're talking hundreds of years that it's been one family in charge of the North, and nobody really had a problem with it until, you know, Ramsay Bolton decided, hey, let's go get our filet on.
Fantastic. God, I miss Ramsay. I love a good bad guy, and I'll be talking about the new bad guy soon enough, but Ramsay was... I liked Ramsay way more than I liked Joffrey. I don't know if that makes me a horrible human being or not, but Joffrey was just whining. At least Ramsay, like, had a fucking plan and went out and did shit.
Joffrey was a bitch. No two ways about it. I mean, the kid who played him was a good actor because he made you fucking hate him. You know, I'll give him that. If nothing else, he made you fucking hate Joffrey. And I didn't really think whoever played him was going to need a lot of help to do that in the first place, but he did it. He hit the essences of the notes of that character. Ramsay was a bitch too, but at least he could back up his, you know, his bitchiness. He was crafty. He was conniving. He actually fucking had some military successes. You know, if it hadn't been for Littlefinger, he probably would have fucked John up too, even with the 1-1, you know. So it would have been a fucking bad day for the North. Although, let's see, Ramsay versus Cersei would have been fucking, that would have been pretty fucking epic. Who could?
As you were saying that, I'm sitting there like, fucking Ramsay versus the Lannisters. In an alternate universe, like, I kind of wish this was a choose-your-own-adventure thing so I could see that possibility play out. It'd be fun.
One of the really fun things, too, just a little fact, is when he originally auditioned for Game of Thrones, he auditioned for Jon's part. And he was one of, like, the finalists who lost it to Kit Harington before they're like, hey, we got another part down the road that we want you to play for us.
Oh, wow. Wow, I mean, I can't picture him in Jon Snow's role anymore, but that's interesting how that worked out. Now, how did... Ramsay was also a bastard, was he not?
Yep, but see, the difference between, like, him, Jon, and Gendry is his dad actually legitimized him by making him his heir. Kind of like what Rob did in the books by making Jon his heir. Even though John never found out about that before Rob died, and, you know, everybody who was with Rob when he did it died. Which would potentially, if they'd put it in the show, made John the legitimate heir, and then Bran showing up in Winterfell wouldn't have been a thing and wouldn't be a big deal. Wouldn't maybe give Sansa something to play into or not, depending upon the way things are going to go in the North.
Right, okay, that makes sense. All right, let's move on a little bit, because as much as it was fun to see it, I mean, it was one of those things that you saw, and actually as I rewatched it, watching that whole thing play out, I actually cared more about Tyrion's dialogue and Davos's. Like, I liked how Davos was, like, basically saying, hey, he's the king, you know, he's not your lord. I enjoyed how he did that, so that cracked me up a little bit. Davos is always on point for me. Was Davos in season 1?
He was, Maybe not. No, he didn't really show up until Stannis did, and I don't think Stannis showed up until season two.
Okay.
Yeah, Davos has always reminded me, again, of Jon, of like a character who will go out of his way to do the right thing rather than necessarily just advance his own cause. Like when he let Gendry go, when he, faced prison, when he, almost tried to kill Melisandre after his fucking sons burned up. He lives by his morals, which you don't see a lot of in fucking Westeros.
Now, do you have any knowledge of... this is a two-part question. A, why he's called the Onion Knight, and B, like, how... Do you know anything about his heritage, his family, like, how he rose up to be, like, Stannis' right-hand man or left-hand man? Do you have any backstory on Davos?
He has no family... Well, no... noble family. He was a fucking peasant fisherman who ended up becoming a smuggler. When he was caught by Stannis, Stannis removed the tips of each one of his fingers, which is, he's only got like two knuckles instead of three, which is why he wears that one glove on his hand, and you know, people remark on it once in a while. I think Tyrion did this episode.
Yep.
He grew up in King's Landing. And he was a smuggler, so that was he knew Braavos, and he had actually been a sailor too. But that was one of the reasons why Stannis sent him to Braavos to try to rally, funds when he brought back all the mercenaries when Stannis invaded the North. So he helped Stannis invade Dragonstone during Robert's Rebellion, and when they succeeded with that, because Stannis is like, "Hey, if you do this, I'll give you a pardon." Stannis pardoned him, made him. A member of the nobility, and he served him loyally ever since then.
All right. Anything about the Onion Knight? How he got the nickname?
Because he used to, I believe, fish when he was a sailor. He would ship produce.
So, oh, fair. Hey, there's a rhyming reason why there's a name, and that's what I'm here to ask. Kind of sticking with Davos a little bit, but. Not with Davos necessarily. Melisandre and Varys had a short but very meaningful conversation, in my opinion. What did you take out of? Is Melisandre leaving and then come back to Westeros, or is she staying? She was a little confusing to me. Want to go tackle that first?
If she goes by exactly what she was saying, she's going to leave, go back, visit the home temple, and come back to die.
Okay, and then she dropped, I don't know, what I thought was the most important bombshell in a way for me was Varys gonna be dying in Westeros. Do you think that's a foreshadow for this season, or do you think it's a foreshadow for next season?
I think there's either two ways to read it. Either that's a foreshadow for probably next season, or she was using that as a veiled threat in reply back to him saying, "Hey, you should probably take off, never come back. Oh, you know, it's dangerous for your health. Oh, why aren't you down there visiting the King of the North when you fucking talked him up so much?" Oh, well, you're going to die too, buddy. Yeah, so.
Right. One thing we do need to know as fans that when you watch the very opening and they show you clips from previous episodes, if you see that clip again, just call up your bookie and be like, "Hey, here's $500 on Varys dying, and you're probably going to make a profit." Because that's what they do.
Yes.
Moving on from there to, there was a tiny little scene with Theon, which, once again, anything that kind of embarrasses Theon or puts him in his place is entertaining to me. We see him in the preview for next week. Do you got anything on this? Like, it just seems like he's going to try to do something, but I can't ever imagine him being successful. Like, is he going to come back to Daenerys, do you think? Or do you think he's going to try, like, some rescue mission?
I didn't get a chance to watch the preview for next week because I was putting my son to bed. But, I think... If
they showed him in like a boat, I think.
I think if he stays one note like he is, it makes him an uninteresting character. if he tries for redemption and either succeeds or fails, that gives him at least a layer of complexity above and beyond just being, oh, this is the guy who fucks up every single time he's on screen, which would be more interesting, in my opinion, than being the guy who fucks up every time he's on screen.
It seems to me, and I mean, Game of Thrones is notorious for a lot of bookending a lot of things. I think Theon's going to fucking try to rescue Yara like Yara tried rescuing him many seasons ago. And this time, maybe he'll be successful and get his redemption in some way, hopefully via death. But I think, I feel like he's got to go on his rescue mission in order to get some kind of sympathy.
I feel almost like a great character arc would be for him to go on a rescue mission, rescue her, gain some kind of redemption, and then when you're seeing him in a positive light, all of a sudden he sees Bran, and Bran's like, fuck you, psh, blows him up.
I still enjoy the thought of Bran fucking him over. And, well, Bran's coming up. I got a lot of things to say about that. But let's talk about not the best scene of the episode, but possibly the best scene. Euron acting like the coolest motherfucking bad guy in the room. Like, he's basically the Game of Thrones what Negan is to Walking Dead. He's making being a complete asshole dickhead, like, cool again, in my opinion. I don't know. What was your favorite part of this whole thing with Euron?
I love how he taunts the shit out of Jaime, and Jaime just can't do anything to respond to it because of his position as Cersei's, you know, right hand. But it's it's
the finger in the bum. Come on, that was a fucking classic line.
Yeah, how does she like it? Does she like it rough? Does she like it soft? Finger in the bum.
I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the first time I can recall a horse being in that area, like in front of the Iron Throne.
Yeah, it's the first time I remember that either, so I was thinking about that myself as they were. I was like, wow, could you imagine how shitty it would be to have to be the dude to clean up the fucking horse shit when the horse just goes in the middle of the throne room?
But Euron just clearly doesn't give a fuck, and at this point, I don't think, I mean, Cersei wants that shit clean, but I don't even think she cares. Like, she's just happy as hell to get, you know, her present, which I love how the present was not Tyrion. And you, I mean, I'm pretty sure you remember in the blog for episode one, I asked what the present was going to be, and a lot of people had the vibe that it was going to be Tyrion. I think we can both agree, we're glad that it wasn't Tyrion. This makes way more sense, and it's easy to lose these characters, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Tyrion, I have a feeling he's going to die because he's a character I like, but I have a feeling it's going to be further on towards the end when everything is starting to look genocidal or like everything's decimated rather than, you know, a big shocker coming, you know, in the middle of this season or in the early episodes of this season.
I think Tyrion's death is going to not be the absolute finale of this show, but the penultimate, the one right before it. I think that's because, you know, there's a lot of shows where they try to give big characters a death, not in the finale, but in the one right before it. Like, I don't know, did you ever watch Sons of Anarchy?
I never watched the whole thing, but I did watch it. And yeah, I mean, just look at like this last season of Grimm, where they killed off two of the main characters, the penultimate episode, you know, literally seconds right before the credits hit.
Right, it just, I don't know, it allows for the final episode to not only reflect on that, but to do, you know, convey the rest of its story that needs to be told. And it gives that character, like, you know, the standing ovation, if you will. So, yeah, I fully expect Tyrion to, unfortunately, get got at some point. Cersei getting the kill with, what was it, the long farewell. I loved that. I loved the fact that she went for that kill. What do you feel?
Yeah, I that was apropos and poetic. You know, up until that point, till she kissed her, I was like, how is this going to go? I knew the daughter was getting it. I knew Illyria was going to be just sitting there, you know, having to go with the repercussion of losing a daughter. Up until then, I was like, wow, is she going to have the mountain crush her head right in front of her? But
that's what I was thinking. I did not foresee the poison coming until I saw the kiss. I was waiting for the mountain. She hasn't unleashed the mountain on anybody yet, has she?
The only time we've seen it was last season when he ripped the dude's jaw off when they came to take Cersei to the
Scepter, right?
He just reached in and ripped the guy's fucking jaw. I was like, damn! Gangsta!
Yeah, I love how stone cold Cersei was. Like, every 3 hours, make sure those torches are relit because this bitch has to see her daughter die. I was like, that is fucking badass. I liked Cersei a lot last season, mainly because I think deep down most fans kind of figured that at some point she was lighting that fucking place up. So she became a likable character to me last season, but she's really... I know she's not a fan favorite anymore, but she's really becoming one of my, like, five favorite characters of this season in particular because of how badass she is. How do you feel about her character?
I have to disagree with you in one thing, and I don't think she's a likable character, but I think she's a very compelling character, which, you know, for TV is probably better than actually having her be a likable person. You know, it's like Walter White when he finally succumbs and becomes, you know, a fucking bad guy, and he realizes that, yeah, I'm not doing this for my family, I'm doing this for me. It's almost more compelling than you know, the misunderstood fucking person who's doing bad, what they're trying to do good, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, she's a bad person. She's in it for herself. I mean, she might be in it for Jaime. I mean, that was a pretty good blowjob that she gave him this episode, but at this point, you know, she's in power to have power. She's doesn't really give a fuck that all of her kids are dead. I mean, she cares. You know, she wants revenge for the people who took them from her. But it's not like, oh, you know, let me go sit here weeping, you know, that my actions led to every single one of my children dying. She's about power. She's about keeping power. And I think she's about burning the world if she's going to lose power. Yeah, one of the things that gets me is people don't realize that everyone who allies with her, you know, is just basically increasing the likelihood of themselves getting fucking murked. Because I don't see, you know, if she somehow manages to keep the Iron Throne when all this shit's settled, I don't see any of their lifetimes being longer than like 30 seconds after that happens. You're on, bye. Anybody else who's helping her, bye. Iron Throne guy, fucking Mark Gatiss from Sherlock, bye. See ya.
So, I mean, first of all, I gotta say, nice to see titties back in an episode. Really happy to see them back. Because really, like, I don't know. Well, last week we got Missande. I can never pronounce her name properly. But it's nice every once in a while.
Just picture Ludacris from Fast and Furious going, man, how come he gets to see that shit and I don't? When that scene happened.
I don't get the reference, but that's okay.
She was in the last couple Fast and Furious movies. You know, like, okay. A character that, like, he likes, you know, so.
I haven't seen a Fast and Furious movie since... I watched a little bit of Part 5. I couldn't stand it, and that was the one where The Rock joined the cast. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to like this. Instead, I hate it, and I haven't watched a single one since then. So, I've missed half the franchise. I'm okay with it. I can live with it. Paul Walker can't. Boom.
That's harsh, dude.
Well, I'm that awful of a human being that I had to go there. Actually, as a matter of fact, I'll go so far as to say Paul Walker, as far as I can remember, I can only remember one movie that I really liked him in where, like, he did a great job acting, and that was a film called Running Scared.
Running Scared was fucking great, dude. I love that.
Right.
Another one that he was really good in was Ours. That was a...
I never saw it. Was it, what kind of movie was it?
It's a drama. It takes place during Hurricane Katrina. I want to say his wife dies in childbirth, and his daughter is premature, is on life support, and they're having to evacuate the hospital, but they can't move the life support that she's on. So, like, the whole movie is him going through and, like, having to restart, like, this hand crank this generator every couple of hours to keep her alive during Katrina, and then, you know, dealing with looters as they're coming into the hospital, dealing with, you know, like, batteries running out for the generator, running out of food, water, that kind of shit. It was pretty good.
I'd watch that. I can admit that. I actually don't even own Running Scared. It's one of those movies that I really like that I don't own, and yet I own a lot of really shitty movies. Makes you think.
That was definitely a dark movie, and I did not call the ending for that one. Although, going back and watching it again the second time, I was like, I should have.
Yeah, it's one of those times. I understand. Let's see, Jamie and Cersei. I don't really have much to say about the whole Jamie and Cersei thing. Like, that was kind of expected. But then Cersei had her little scene with the banker. And I will ashamedly admit that that was so obvious what was going to happen later on in the episode. And yet, I still didn't see it coming. Did the banker scene... Like, I was like, eventually they'll get to Highgarden. And I didn't think it was happening this particular week, though. Did you think that was foreshadowing for this particular episode?
I did not. No, not at all. I mean, I had heard a spoiler that Olenna was going to die this week, but I didn't see that happening the way it did.
You know, spoilers just need to go up and die. Seriously, like, why do we live in a... Who gets the satisfaction of leaking spoilers? It really kind of pisses me off, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I like wrestling spoilers a little bit, but I'd probably enjoy the product a lot more if I didn't read spoilers. I don't know. Like, it's different if you read the source material. Like, in Game of Thrones, if you'd read the books beforehand, you kind of know what to expect. That's fine. That's not spoilers, though. I hate flat out, hey, by the way, this week, this person's going to die. Go fuck yourself.
I mean, the worst thing now isn't even that the spoilers are out there. It would be fine if they were and they were like in an isolated, secluded area of the internet or something. But because Game of Thrones and, you know, all the popular media that I follow is so popular right now, it's like as soon as you log into the internet, you know, Yahoo, Facebook, Google, whatever, all of a sudden, all these fucking spoilers are like the top stories. So you can't even fucking hide from it. I go to log into my internet, you know, just to check my Yahoo, and boom, right on the homepage, fucking, oh, who dies in Game of Thrones this week? Oh, Olenna, blah, 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 you know, that kind of shit, so.
Right, like, the spoilers are too much in our face, and it really, it sucks, and like, you know, I feel a lot of people watch these more popular shows in hopes that they can outrun the spoilers, because if you wait like an hour after Game of Thrones, some asshole on Facebook has posted that so-and-so has died on Game of Thrones, on Walking Dead, on, you know, whatever the popular show of the fucking month is. It sucks. Really sucks. Like, I'm terrified of the fact that due to my October schedule, I'm not going to be able to watch Stranger Things until November 1st. I have to go 4 days avoiding that somehow. I don't know how that's going to be possible.
Well, you should be busy enough that you won't ever actually have a chance to even see it, so.
The problem is that I got to post a lot of shit on Facebook. That's going to be the big deterrent. It sucks. Like, I don't know how to get around that. So, I'm basically going to forewarn all my friends that if they post a single spoiler, I will immediately unfriend them, and I am that much of a jerk that I will I've done it before. I have straight up unfriended somebody when they ruined one of the big deaths in Sons of Anarchy. I was so pissed. Boom. Done. Don't be that person. I will unfriend you immediately. I think that's fair. Do you?
I try not to let stuff like that bother me too much, but you know, I think this is the people who try to spoil it for others are fucking retarded. I mean, I can understand the clickbait news journalists on the internet who make their money by putting up articles discussing Game of Thrones or what have you. I can understand the bloggers who, you know, this is what they do. I don't understand those assholes who are just like, oh, I guess you died on Facebook, haha. They can go to fucking hell.
Right. But they have no value.
I mean, if you're my friend, I'm not going to stop being a friend with you over that shit. I might punch you in the fucking face the next time I see you, but I mean, after that, it's over, so.
I will unfriend them. If they're a good enough friend, they will contact me and be like, hey, why'd you unfriend me? I'm like, hey, why are you such a dick? So, I'll have that conversation with them at that point. It's a conversation starter, quite frankly. It's very nice. It's an eloquent thing. So, moving on back to Game of Thrones, we had the Tyrion and Jon conversation, which leads to Tyrion convincing Daenerys, and then the whole thing about they're wondering what Davos meant about Jon getting stabbed in the heart. I don't know why did they make such a big deal about that particular line?
I think because if it's true, she's like, what the fuck? How the hell is this?
Like, as a threat, do you think? Do you think, like, she's threatened by knowing that this dude survived getting stabbed in the heart? Or is it more just wonderment?
Wonderment, curiosity, like, is she being literal or figurative? You know, maybe, I don't see her being that dark, but maybe even, oh, well, if he can fucking come back from the dead, what's the, you know, how can I fucking hook it up so... something happens when I'm fucking flying around on my dragon, burning people to death, you know, doing my Trognor impression. How can I come back? So,
was it any possible foreshadowing based on the fact that not only did Davos say it, then Daenerys and Tyrion had the conversation, but also Missandei also said to her, hey, you can't just take the three dragons burned down because, you know, an arrow could get you. Is there any possible foreshadowed there?
Maybe. I mean, one of the things that, I think they get into a little bit in the book, since it's been a while since I read it, is, it's not just them going through and choosing at random, oh, okay, this guy died, so we'll fucking bring him back. It's like, when they request to bring somebody back, the Lord of Light gives in and allows them to bring this particular person back. So, if the Lord of Light has a plan for Daenerys, and I have a feeling that Melisandre would be staying around if she did. Then, yeah, it's definitely possible, and she could be fucking like Beric Dondarrion or Jon Snow or, you know, Lady Stoneheart in the books. If she doesn't, then it doesn't matter. You know, they can pray all they want. He's not letting her go back.
I mean, I'll go on record now and say that I think that was definite foreshadowing. That's the right reason why Melisandre's down there, and she's going to go to her fucking temple and then come back to Westeros and do the life-saving thing. I'm saying right now that was this episode of foreshadowing to Daenerys getting hit by an arrow, possibly at the season finale, so we have another stupid-ass cliffhanger. I hope we don't get another cliffhanger because I hate cliffhangers, but I think it's happening. I feel that they focus too much on it to not have it, you know, play out. John and Danny had their talk. You can mine the Dragonstone, all that stuff. I don't know. I don't really have anything to say about it. Do you have anything of importance to say about that particular little tidbit?
No, they were definitely much more reasonable with each other, and I see like a grudging respect maybe starting from that point on compared to the way she was way more dismissive at the beginning. Same thing with him. I mean, I want to say I really think that the reason that he stopped when he walked into the throne room was because he thought she was hot, but, you know, subtlety is definitely not maybe one of Kit Harington's specialties. So, we'll have to see.
Yeah, That's interesting. Yeah, it was kind of like they got over their pissing contest, put their fucking big boy pants on, and had an adult conversation. So that was nice.
I really think that a lot of their interactions in this episode was the setup for her getting fucked over in regards to Highgarden and Casterly Rock in order to make it so that she has to work together with Jon rather than just being able to be, you know, in the position of overwhelming power and say, if you don't bend the knee to me, you're fucked.
Which, once again, it was kind of like this whole episode, when I rewatched it, there are so many foreshadows to what's going to happen, but I didn't see it coming. But you're right. Like, the past two episodes have just been forcing Daenerys' hand to join up with Jon begrudgingly, happily, whatever. Like, they're forcing her hand because her allies are just getting taken out one by one. So it was all a beautiful setup, really. I guess that's why I really am holding this episode in high regard. Let's move on to a good amount of stuff here. The whole thing with Sansa, Littlefinger, and then Bran. I felt that Sansa was doing very good in control and in charge. I get the feeling from what I've read online, a lot of people are saying like Littlefinger's being very manipulative in what he was saying to her. I didn't see it that way. I thought that was like some of the best advice Littlefinger's ever given anybody in this whole series. How do you feel about his advice?
I don't think it's necessarily great advice because it leads to a very long and lonely, paranoid life. But I think he's definitely giving us an insight into, you know, this is how I'm fucking thinking. This is how I caused all fucking seven kingdoms to go to war. This is how I'm still alive and all the people who are fucking over me are dead. And this is how I'm planning on being around after everybody else who's still around is dead and picking up the pieces. Oh, and you for a booty call after all this shit's finished.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly... I love that he finally... I don't know if he'd really ever given anybody that depth of his thinking before, so that was welcome. And then it just became like they had that moment, and then Bran shows up. As I asked in the blog at 9deuce.com, I asked, why doesn't Bran see what Littlefinger is up to? Like, he even says he can see the future and stuff. So why is it that he doesn't see this? Or is he not allowed to tell Sansa this? Like, is there, like, a code of ethics being the three-eyed raven?
I think it's less, like, not seeing it, less a code of ethics, and less, he's still mortal. He doesn't see everything all this. He has to choose where he's looking. So if he's not looking at Littlefinger, if he's not looking at all the fucking scheming that the guy's doing... it's just, if it doesn't hit in any of the shit that he's looking at, it's gonna not fly under his, it's gonna fly under his radar.
Gotcha. So that could be actually an interesting subplot, is if, you know, he's busy doing his fucking thing and all of a sudden Bran's like, I wonder what's gonna happen with Sansa. And then suddenly, like, he foresees this. Like, that could be a really cool little subplot for this season, I think. I also think everything to do with Bran has potential to be amazing. It's just a matter of what they do with him.
I think one of the most interesting things in the books, if we ever get to the point we're at in the show, like if he ever finishes the ones that he's supposed to be writing, will be the fact that, you know, even though so many years have gone by in the show, the kid in the books is still years younger than Isaac Hempstead Wright is. So, you know, even more fucked up, more... like, what was it, Village of the Damned, where the kids were all fucking smart and eerie and shit. You know, yep. Rather than, you know, okay, this kid's fucking tall as shit, turned into a teenager, like, Hodor would probably have trouble carrying him in another year or two. Yeah. So, I think that would be interesting to see. I'm really doubting we're ever going to get the end of the books, though.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder that myself. But, you know, I mean... that happened, I mean, it was a big problem in Walking Dead, because up to the point where we're at in the TV show, in the comics, Carl was still the same age he was in episode one of season one, basically. Like, they'd be, I don't even know, maybe a year older at most. Like, he was still a kid, and yet, you know, he's hit puberty and is becoming a young man at this point, same as Bran started off as this wall-climbing guy who gets shoved out of the window by Jaime, which was awesome as hell. But, you know, it's weird, because the only other alternative is to recast the character every season, which would just be terrible, I think.
Did you watch The Strain at all?
No, somebody just recommended that to me, and no, I haven't.
Between season one and season two, they recast the kid, and the kid they got in season two and season three, and I'm assuming season four, is just like probably the second worst child actor I've ever seen after Jake Lloyd. So it's just fucking, ugh. Every time I see him, I just wish he would die.
Worse than Dakota Fanning?
I liked a lot of shit that Dakota Fanning did. I mean...
a lot of the shit she did, yes, but her acting in those good movies was garbage for me. Like, all she did was scream and cry. I mean, yeah, I'm blaming her for War of the Worlds, despite there being a lot of other issues with that god-awful movie. But, yeah, she was part of it. she's part of the reason why I like, she makes me cringe watching Man on Fire. She's the one part of that movie that I don't like. I love that movie otherwise.
I mean, Man on Fire wasn't bad. I blame Spielberg for War of the Worlds. He was trying to Michael Bay it up. It shows you what happens when he's not Spielberg.
That I don't know if War of the Worlds gets enough credit for... It has to be one of the 10 worst remakes ever. Would you not agree?
Maybe not. No, there's definitely worse remakes. I mean, look at Point Break. I think War of the Worlds had some good scenes. Like, I think the whole scene with Tim Robbins in the basement was pretty decent. The problem was it really feels to me it does like Spielberg was trying to step away from his typical style of directing and do something different, and he didn't succeed at what he was trying to do.
And that's why I will always give props to Tarantino. He never, like, he's tried some different things, but at its base, if you just were given, you know, any movies beyond Pulp Fiction and didn't know who the director was, you would actually still know it was Tarantino, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he's stepped into different genres, but, I mean, at the core, they're all relatively simple movies with simple plots, just multi-layered dialogue and character interactions. I would say that, you know, the nuanced dialogue and characterization is what separates, you know, him from everybody else. I mean, Kill Bill, simple revenge plot. Inglourious Bastards, pretty simple plot. Django, pretty simple plot. Hateful Eight, pretty simple plot. Pulp Fiction, pretty simple plot, although the way it was filmed was, you know, almost groundbreaking for the time. You know, Reservoir Dogs, pretty simple plot. Three rooms, basically, setting. I mean, shit, how much did he save on not filming the bank scene and just leaving it off stage?
Yeah, I mean, all it was the chase scene where the cops are chasing down Buscemi, so, yeah, they saved a lot of money. I also have to ashamedly admit something that I really hate to admit here, but I feel obligated to. I did not like Pulp Fiction the first time I watched it. Really did not enjoy it. I felt there were some things in it that I liked, so I was like, I know it got a lot of hype, let me rewatch it, and the more times I watched it, the more, like, I came around after probably about, like, the third showing, but initially, I didn't like the movie. Hate to admit it.
Part of the problems I had with Pulp Fiction when it came out was my age, and,
Yes, because we're the same age, right?
I was 79.
Okay, I was 80. So, yeah, we're same age. So same issue.
And it was my age and just my exposure to film up until that point. I mean, you know, I was in my basic mind, you know, I'm still used back then, you know, oh, okay, we got one hero, we got a villain, your story follows a strict line. You know, I wasn't really into the whole Shades of Grey thing. I hadn't become an adult and seen the way the world actually functions, I should say. And so, you know, seeing basically what amounted to, you know, one of my first really black comedies, you know, with no heroes, everybody's morally gray, you know, all these situations that are fucked up. You know, I saw a lot of the humor in it, but wasn't focusing on, like, you know, the fact that it was different than what I was expecting, you know, a typical movie to be, didn't appeal to me as much as it does now when I go back and I just look at, like, the genius of how it was filmed, you know, the way the dialogue flowed naturally, you know, the fucking, do you believe a motherfucking acts of God? Bam! You know, kind of shit, so.
Yeah, and the pacing, how it was cut up and stuff, I mean, let's not forget, that year, fucking Shawshank Redemption and Forrest Gump, those are the types of films that we were used to. Our tiny little fucking brains could handle and metabolize that because it was a straightforward, from beginning to end type story, and the characters were all, you know, here's the good guy, here's the bad guy type thing. And Pulp Fiction just really did a number. It was, I mean, yeah, it was one of those movies that was absolutely a turning point in me liking films in a different way. I would say, like, that Natural Born Killers. I mean, that also changed things.
I mean, a lot of it depends on, too, on, like, where you grew up from. Like, my family loved to watch movies, loved to watch shows, but, like, even talking to my mom now, she would rather sit down and watch a Disney movie that makes her feel happy rather than, you know, something to me that I really enjoy, which usually ends up being dark or depressing or, you know, I would think a much more realistic example of human behavior. Like, not to say that those movies weren't out there before Tarantino, but when you're 13, 14, 15, who's going to say, oh, you really like movies? You should sit down and watch, you know, Taxi Driver. Who's gonna recommend that to, you know, a 12-year-old?
Well, yeah, it's like recommending The Godfather to a 12-year-old. You're just not getting it.
Yeah, so as you get older and you experience more of the world and you realize more that, you know, everything is in a shade of black and white, that's when you also begin to experience more of the, I would say, like, archetypes of film. Like, yeah, you might have seen the Shining, you know, to go back to, you know, the very first blog we did together when you were younger, but it probably wouldn't have resonated or appealed or even just, you know, you wouldn't have understand what, you know, great performances were in that movie, you know, how sublime Kubrick's directing was until you went back as an adult and were able to appreciate, you know, what went into making it in addition to just, you know, what went into the story.
Oh, sure. Like, when I was a kid, when I was like 5 years old watching The Shining, I viewed it through Danny's eyes, pretty much. Like, that's how I viewed it. Like, a lot of the talky stuff I wasn't interested in, but, like, the creepy stuff kind of, and, like, you know, Danny being afraid of, like, seeing the twins and stuff, like, that stuff resonated with me as a kid. And you're right, like, I gave zero fucks about how great Jack Nicholson was. I didn't care. I didn't care about the directing. I didn't know who Jack Nicholson was until, God damn, I have no idea. I think I didn't really pay attention to who Jack Nicholson was until Batman came out.
He was a non-entity for us. I mean, I kind of knew who he was a little bit. I mean, I remember my family being really, you know, like my mom and my aunts being really excited over Witches of Eastwick, which I want to say I think came out in like 86 or 87. But, you know, one of my aunts on my dad's side was an actress, and she made it professional, but she only did, you know, bit parts, like, walk on roll here, you know, or she might have had like one line in a, you know, she was in a Family Matters episode once, and she was like sitting there next to Carl holding a Christmas tree when he and Urkel got stuck on a subway, kind of shit. So she was in like a movie called Frisky's Honor back in the early 80s, and he was in that with Angelica Houston. So, you know, I was aware of who he was, but I'd never seen him, never knew who he was. And then Batman came out, and of course, you know, what little kid doesn't want to go see the Batman movie? And all of a sudden, here's Jack Nicholson playing the Joker, and everybody's going on about how awesome he is. And, you know, so, okay, yeah, that was definitely the first time that he showed up. I mean, it's the same kind of thing with, like, The Exorcist. You know, it was scary when I was a kid, but then, you know, I think now as an adult, you know, going back, like, what the hell they put Linda Blair through when she was fucking filming that? I'm like, yeah, it's really easy to see how that fucked her up for like fucking 20 years afterwards.
Oh yeah, kids in horror movies, I don't understand how they grow up to have normal lives. Like, I'm actually very impressed by Drew Barrymore because she did a lot of, I mean, she did E.T. She also did Firestarter. She also did Cat's Eye. Like, she saw some pretty weird shit as a child. All things concerned, she's grown up to be fairly normalized, I guess would be the term I want to use here.
She did the smart thing, and she got all the drinking, the drugs, and the alcohol, and the partying out of the way when she was like 12 and 13. So by the time she hit adulthood, you know, she could just be an adult and get back to being successful.
I so wish I would have done that route. So do. Oh, well.
Like, I was reading that, you know, what was the kid's name in The Shining who played Danny? He didn't know he was filming a scary movie. He thought he was just filming a drama. You know, Kubrick kept everything that was scary about the movie away from him, except just, you know, the scenes that he had to film.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, really, you don't want to fucking traumatize a child. And it's weird. Like, I wish there was, like, a book about all the childhood experiences of children in horror movies. That'd be a good book for me.
It would be interesting for sure, that's for sure. Well, then again, though, I mean, how many people are actually going to be picking up, you know, a lot of really memorable memories when they're that age? I mean, my age now, stuff from 5 and 6 is hazy, so.
That's true, and honestly, it's weird, but really one of the few memories I do have from that age was The Shining and the nightmares I had of the hedge garden maze. Like, I don't really remember that much in that time frame, obviously, at this point. But yeah, that is actually one of those few memories I do have, so that's great. Let's move on. We got 3 more segments to talk about.
I was gonna
say,
let's get back to Game of Thrones.
We got Jorah and Samwell and I don't know, is he the Grand Maester, or does he have a different title?
I think he's the Grand Maester. Whatever he is, he's the number one head honcho, and I'm really liking the job that, what the hell's his name, is doing playing him.
Yeah, he's doing a really good job. I'm enjoying what's an otherwise kind of a mundane thing, but they've actually made, I don't know, I didn't foresee Samwell's scenes being all that enjoyable this season. I was like, it's just going to be him learning. Boring. They're probably going to not have him on many episodes. No, instead they're killing it with his character and his scenes. And I not only did I enjoy it, I liked how, you know, the Grand Maester is like, oh, you thought you were going to go away unpunished? Well, no. So I enjoyed that, but I think I asked this on the blog. How do you think Jorah's going to find Daenerys?
I'm assuming that at this point it's pretty much common knowledge that she's in Dragonstone. I mean, Cersei knows it. Jon knew it. Dorne knew it. The Iron Islands knew it. So if he doesn't know by now, all he's going to have to do is, like, go to the nearest tavern and, hey, where can I find fucking Daenerys? They're going to be like, oh, Dragonstone. And he's be like, okay, see you.
Well, that's something that I've often wondered about the world of Game of Thrones. Because we know that, you know, word gets around, you know, Varys has his methods. They have the fucking ravens with the fucking messages and whatnot. I've often wondered how much of that knowledge gets trickled down to the everyday common folks. And from your answer, it sounds like it's becomes fairly quick worldwide knowledge, basically, right?
Well, like, I would assume, for example, that, you know, most common folks wouldn't give a fuck about, you know, the intricacies of the politics, but they would be paying attention to the shit that's going to affect them in the long road. Like, who's going to be marching their armies through here that are going to fucking steal my food, kill me, and fuck up my family, you know, rape my daughters, kill my family. So that's the kind of stuff that I would assume they would be paying attention to.
So, I mean, we've had John and Danny, we have Jorah and Samwell. Do you think we're going to have any other pairings of somebody from Danny's side and somebody from John's side? I've been trying to think, like, possibilities, and since Arya is so close to Winterfell, she kind of seems out of it. Do you foresee any other pairings this season, or do you think that this is kind of it for the pairings?
Well, an interesting pairing would be Little Lady Mormont and her uncle Jorah, who was fled the country instead of going to take the Black for dealing in slaves and was kicked out of his family completely. So that could be interesting.
Yes. I would like to see that, and I will go on record to say any extra scenes with Lady Mormont is more than welcome in my eyes. I can't wait. I'm almost afraid of what her career is going to be after Game of Thrones. Like, I don't know how you cast that girl, but she is so good at what she does. I really hope that whoever gets her for a TV or a movie role, I really hope they do her justice, because that girl seems like she has all the potential in the fucking world.
She's awesome.
Really enjoyable.
Yeah. If John had just married her, they would have already had all 7 kingdoms by now.
Oh, well, hell yeah.
Creepy, but, you know.
Whatever. It's cool. It's Game of Thrones. Everybody just accepts it. So, now comes to, like, the whole Unsullied coming to Casterly Rock, and Tyrion's telling the like doing the voiceover and stuff. And I'm still, it's weird. I still am not quite fully picking up on what's coming later. I just thought like it was interesting that he was narrating. Oh well, the climb going up the wall is going to be difficult, but hey, there's this fucking cave, and you can go up through the sewers. I didn't think anything more about it. I still was dumb to it. Were you still dumb to it at that point?
You mean in regards to them getting fucked up from behind?
Basically in the fact that, you know, most of the Lannister army wasn't there.
I mean, we didn't get the fact that most of the Lannister army wasn't there until, you know, right at the end when he said, there were supposed to be more of you. And all of a sudden, we're like, oh, where are they at? So, I mean, it was a bait and switch, but it was one we probably couldn't really have seen because of the way they filmed it. So,
I also really love the touch of having Euron destroying all those ships. Like, that was such a clutch maneuver on Cersei's side. That was beyond clutch, quite frankly. Do you think the Lannister army that was stuck at Casterly Rock did, like, were they just already accepting of their fate, or do you, I mean, how do you feel knowing that, like, you're basically just there to get killed?
I have a feeling that they don't get told that that's what's happening. They're just like, all right, guys, we're taking the rest of the army over to Highgarden. You guys stay here, make sure nobody comes in, and we'll be good. And then all of a sudden, the Unsullied show up, and they're like, fuck me.
Fair enough.
One question that comes down to this episode, and it's a question of timelines, is, you know, if all of this shit is happening relatively close to together, how does Euron go from dragging his fucking captives through King's Landing to assaulting Casterly Rock and taking out the rest of that in, like, a matter of hours? You know. Obviously,
well,
it didn't occur that quickly, but, you know, what's the case, you know, days, weeks, you know, how is this shit all kind of getting lumped together? You know, and if it's being weeks, how come Arya hasn't made it to Winterfell yet, but Bran's already made it fucking the trek all the way from the fucking wall? You know, that kind of shit.
Sure. I mean, that is a very poignant question, because we've seen that Euron had enough time to take out the Greyjoys and Sand Snakes, that little trek, go all the way up to King's Landing, then come back down. And it seemed to me that both the Greyjoys fleet and Grey Worm's fleet were sent out right around the same time frame.
Yeah, they were supposed to be sent out right at the same time.
So how the hell does that, like, did Euron possibly, like, just get, like, do you think he attacked them close to Dragonstone, or do you think they were, like, mid-trip? I mean, it's really tough to add this timeline up now that you mention it.
I'm thinking it's convenient storytelling to make a compelling sense of Dany being in trouble, seeing her fly out on the dragon next episode, and having to force her to ally with Jon. Other than that, I think it defies the laws of physics, which apparently aren't very strong in the Seven Kingdoms, so there you have it.
Yeah, I mean, we do have magic and stuff, and Euron does have that one ship that looks fucking beyond amazing. I mean, really, that is probably the coolest ship I've ever seen.
He needs to shout, release the Kraken!
Oh, God. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Also, by the way, now that they said The Walking Dead on this show, I'm hoping at some point on Walking Dead, like, somebody says something to, like, Rick or Negan, like, hey, what the fuck, are we playing this Game of Thrones here shit or something? Like, come on. I hope they fucking do that. It'd be funny.
Be like, hey, we need to gathering up all of our food because, hey, winter's coming.
Winter's coming. Hell, if Daryl's like, hey, Rick, you know, we could really use 3 dragons. Something. Just a little nod would be great.
Rick, when you play this Game of Thrones with Negan, you win or you die.
Ah, there you go. That's all it needs. It just needs to be a nice little gesture. So based on where Casterly Rock is, you said that's in the west. how, like, basically the Unsullied need to march all the way. Where are they going to be heading? Are they heading to King's Landing next? Back to Dragonstone? Like, did they really state what the backup plan is?
I think the idea is that now the Unsullied are going to be stuck in Casterly Rock, cut off by Cersei's forces. You know, so Dany would have to leave Dragonstone in order to save them, or just give up on that portion of her army. Well, I mean, that being the case, it doesn't really make sense based on geography. But, I mean, at the same time, you know, Jaime's forces marched all the way across the width of the Seven Kingdoms to get to Highgarden to attack at the same amount of time that, you know, these guys were sailing only a couple hundred miles to get to Casterly Rock. You know, yeah. None of that makes sense if you look at the maps and you try to follow the geography that's been posted. So I'll just ignore it.
I mean, it's a safe assumption that well over 90%, 95% of the TV show fans are not people that know their maps by heart. Like, they're ignorant fools like I am that we're just like, hey, they just showed up. I don't know where the fuck they came from, but hey, they showed up. So I'm not going to question it. Where then there's, like, you know, the small group of informed people that actually know, and you're all sitting there like, the fuck, this don't make much sense.
Well, one of the things that was cool with the TV show that never happened in the books or in any of the other shit that he's published is the only map he's ever shown has been Westeros. He's never shown anything that happened over where Dany was for, like, the first six seasons. So when they were going through and doing the maps and showing you, you know, Meereen, Dos Dothrak, Braavos, Pentos, Karth, you know, you're seeing them, you know, in regards to where they're relatively supposed to be, you know, for the first time for all that shit.
Speaking of Karth, and I may be having my places really mixed up here, but I know you remember this because if I remember it, you have to remember it. In, like, season two, there was that weird lady and, like, they were going to, like, poison Daenerys with a drink or something, and, like, that crazy bitch talked to her and said some weird shit. Do you remember that? And, like, I feel like her name begins with a Q. Like, Ser Barristan, like, stopped her from drinking it, or maybe it was Jorah, one or the other.
What's the question? What's the actual question, Kent?
Like, who is that, and will she have any relevance moving forward? Because I remember a couple years ago, the YouTube was like, hey, when's she coming back? Like, does she have any role moving forward?
I'm pretty sure she doesn't. No.
So she was just like this one-off, like, creepy fortune teller weird lady.
I think if the person you're talking about is who I'm thinking of, the prophecy that she gave was the important part, and she was just kind of, like, not important at all.
All right, just like the delivery boy. All right, fair enough. Well, we've gone through the whole episode. Time to talk about the fucking big time ending. I know Olenna had a lot of great one-liners. And I liked a lot of what Jaime had to say, too. Did you find it interesting? I'm pretty sure in this episode they mentioned all three of the Lannister children this episode, did they not?
They talked about Joffrey, they talked about Tommen, and they talked about... what's her face?
Marcella. Yes, thank you. Yeah. So, I don't know. I found it interesting that all three kids were mentioned. And, you know, that goes back. There was something I wanted to say. You talked, when we were talking about Cersei, you said something about Cersei, I don't know, something about how she's doing as far as the kids go. But wasn't she banned from, like, going to, like, one of their funerals, like Marcella's funeral or something? That was a thing at one point, right?
Shit. Yeah, she might have been. Trying to remember back that far. She might have. Yeah, she still might have been stuck in the keep when that happened.
Yeah, I think so. So I think that whole thing is what I know. She's always had like a certain perspective, obviously, but I think that one event of not of like her daughter dying and not being able to go to the funeral itself, I think that flipped the switch. Like, to use a sports analogy, that's like fucking Michael Jordan going against the Bad Boy Pistons and getting his ass handed to him for two seasons and then coming back to being the all-time greatest baller, so to speak. I think that's what happened to Cersei. I just compared her, Cersei to Michael Jordan, and I'm okay with it. How did you... I mean, this is one of the best filmed scenes, possibly, in Game of Thrones history. For a non-action battle scene, I don't know if it gets much better than Jaime and Olenna's whole scene. What do you think?
She's been privy to some of the best conversational scenes in the entire show. I mean, the very first one when she shows up, when she's talking with Sansa and Margaery over what kind of person Joffrey is, to the one that she had with Tywin where he's talking about how her kids are homosexual and she's talking about how his kids are incestuous. I mean, that was a great scene too. I'm glad to see that, you know, somebody of her age has actually been given a decent, significant part at a, you know, multicultural, multi-generational show, and she's been one of the fan favorites ever since she first appeared, and it's easy to see why. She's just gotten some of the best lines.
Oh yeah, she had a huge built-in fan base from anybody who ever liked the Golden Girls. If she was in the Golden Girls, she would have been just as lovable as those four ladies. Like, she just had that presence, and the wit about her was phenomenal. Do you think Jaime will tell Cersei about Olenna poisoning Joffrey? I would assume he will, because he wants to get some heat off of Tyrion, whether Cersei will believe him or not, but what do you
think? Well, the one thing to remember about Jaime is that as much as all three of the siblings hated their father, but Jaime loved both of Cersei, and he loved Tyrion too. I mean, that was his thing. He was about both of his siblings. Cersei always hated Tyrion. She blamed him for their mother's death, which caused her to grow up without a mother, and she felt unloved, and blah, 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 didn't get hugged enough, whatever. But Jaime and Tyrion used to spend a lot of time together, and she was jealous of that. So she jumped on every bandwagon to go against Tyrion, blamed him for Joffrey's death, blamed him for their father's death, blamed him for, you know, fucking every evil thing that happened in the Seven Kingdoms, just like a lot of other people did. And Jaime defended him and defended him and defended him and defended him until Tyrion, you know, told him, hey, I killed your son, in a moment of trying to hurt Jaime before he took off and killed his father. So I think, yeah, Jaime's definitely going to tell her, because it shows that, you know, all this shit that you've been blaming him for wasn't necessarily his fault. Whether or not that has any implications into her and Jaime's relationship going forward, we'll have to see. But I don't see them going longer than one episode before it gets brought up.
I think it's interesting that... I think Tyrion's widely considered to be one of the most relatable characters in the whole series. I think Jaime is just as relatable as Tyrion. I mean, aside from fucking your sister, a lot of the things that... I mean, Jaime's kind of like been put in a position where he's had to kind of do some bad things early on, knows what's up, and kind of wants to redeem himself, but keeps getting stuck in some shit. In a way, I find that way more relatable than Tyrion. I don't know, am I wrong in saying that Jaime's just as relatable as Tyrion, if not more?
You know, Tyrion's that part of us that, you know, always feels like we're ugly, or, you know, we're never as good as we could be. Jaime's the part of us that wants to do the right thing and sometimes is able to, but does the pragmatic thing no matter what it is going forward. Jaime's the one who fucks up for love, you know, and that's his major failing. But I mean, like, look at when he was talking with Ned, you know, back in what, season one, he's like, you know, look at this is the book of the deeds of the Kingsguard.
Why do you think Jaime talked Cersei out of the brutal killings to go for a more subtle one on Olenna? Like, I don't know, maybe it's something obvious that I missed. What do you feel was his motivation?
I think it's just the fact that he's a humane person compared to her. You know, and I think if he had known that she was the one who killed his son, it would have been a different story. I mean, you could see him struggling right at the end there to not pull a sword and fuck her up, but...
Right. Was you expecting him to?
I could see it going either way, like it did. I mean, Kristen and I were sitting there watching it.
Yeah, I don't know. I once she made that revelation, I'm sitting there like, Jamie's gonna fucking pull that sword out. Especially after she mocked the name of the sword. I thought that was a definite foreshadow that he was going to end her with the sword, but he just walked away, which... once again, says a lot about Jaime and his character. So, very interesting, very compelling episode. I don't know. Like, seriously, I don't think the next season can top what we just saw. But hey, here's to hoping that it can. Do you think we're going to get some Arya and possibly get to see where the Hound is come next episode? Or do you think they're going to still focus on this big Daenerys, Jon, and Cersei stuff?
We'll definitely see Arya and Hound next episode. I mean, if you look at all of the storylines from the first episode that were left out of this one, they were pretty much it. So,
yeah, I definitely am looking forward to that. I also enjoyed, I kind of forgot to mention, I liked how Bran, when Sansa's like, well, you can be the fucking true ruler of the North. And he's just like, nah, bitch, I'm cool. I'm the three-eyed raven. Like, it wasn't cocky, but he was so calm and chill about it. I really loved how he acted, like how he pulled that whole scene off. I thought it was a really wonderful job acting.
What's the three-eyed raven? Well, it's complicated. Too complicated for you to understand.
Yeah, it was like such, like, just...
try making me understand it.
No, I don't want to, okay? Like, just so dismissive. It was, I don't know, cracked me up. Also, my favorite character that we haven't seen in a while showed up this week. Didn't say a word, but we got to see Bronn.
Bronn, yep.
Do you think he's going to get Highgarden?
No, if anybody got Highgarden, it would be Sam's dad, like what Jamie was talking to him, you know, in order to get all of the number of troops that would be necessary to be able to take Highgarden and leave some of his troops back at Casterly Rock.
I really hate that that's your answer, because I think that you're right, but I still hate it because I want Bronn to own Highgarden. I just do. At some point, is Bronn strictly like on the Lannister side, or is he just on the side that'll pay him the most money? Do we have any insight from the book about his character?
He was a mercenary. I would say at this point in time, with the amount of shit that he's done with them, he's got an attachment to Jaime. He's got an attachment to Tyrion. But whether or not those could trump him being over the side of the people who pay him, who, you know, hold his loyalty with their coin, would be something to see. I mean, I have a feeling that he would help Jaime or Tyrion out in a pinch, but I don't think he would ever like risk his life to do so.
I'm going to even go so far as to say of top three things that I want to see, along with Clegane Bowl and probably something else I'm completely overlooking, I really just want one scene at the very least with Tyrion, Jaime, and Bronn all together in the same room. I don't care what the conversation is. I really don't care, but I just want to see it happen. Just for me. Also, loved the fact that Olenna quoted the Reigns of Castamere song.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
I was like, I know that song. That's something I actually remember. Yay. What do you think we, if we're peering into the future next week, do you think Cersei's going to keep holding the upper hand all season long? I'm starting to get the feeling that, like, episode one, they kind of painted her into, like, this wall of, like, well, she's spread too thin, and now all of a sudden she seems to be having a good chunk of control here. Do you think she's going to continue the whole season, or do you think she's going to get shut down sooner than later?
Well, while she's managed to take the upper hand over the last couple of episodes, she's still spread way too thin. I mean, she lost, what, half of the Lannister army up in Casterly Rock? So even though, I mean, look at what she's got. She's lost half of her the Lannister army. She's got the King's army, but that's, you know, not huge. I mean, compared to otherwise, Joffrey would have been able to fucking just go through and take out everybody when the rebellions all started. I mean, she still doesn't have Dorne. She's got the Highgarden people, but she doesn't have the Eyrie. She doesn't have the Stormlands. She doesn't have the North. She's got the Iron Islanders, but who knows, you know, how long she's going to be able to string them along. And what she doesn't have are dragons or a huge horde of Dothraki, you know, who can just start storming in. So Cersei's good up until the point of one of the allies that she has falls, and then I don't think she has enough to just hold back the onslaught that's going to be coming. I still think she's going to be biting it before the end of the season.
I mean, obviously, this coming episode, we're going to see her pay off her debt. I'm still wondering if she's going to try to pull off an attack on another land. I'm going to go out and say possibly the Vale. I think that'd make the most interesting thing because of they need to pick up steam with Littlefinger. Wouldn't the Vale make the most compelling argument at this point for storyline on the TV show, do you think?
It wouldn't. I mean, there's strategically nothing there, really. And I mean, that they'd have to invade through that narrow mountain pass to be even able to get there. I mean, for the most part, all of the people who are important are with Littlefinger in the north, so you wouldn't be really losing much there. I have a feeling we'll see Hound. I have a feeling we'll see Sansa. We'll see Daenerys fuck some shit up. Looks like there's going to be a little bit of Jon and interaction going on at Dragonstone. Look, a little bit of Sansa and up north. And who the fuck knows? What else? The Theon shit in the boat. What else?
Theon, maybe Jorah. Yeah. I'm wondering we see Jorah. Yeah, I'm hoping Jorah.
Obviously, Sam's got more shit to play. We'll have all that shit coming together, so.
Alright, here's another fun question. Will we see Robin Arryn get, like, beheaded by the end of the season? Because I just want to see that happen. Do you think it's going to?
I don't know. I mean, he's creepy and weird, and I don't know if we'll ever actually get back to the point where we'll be seeing him again. It's all going to depend on how close Littlefinger sticks to Sansa, or if he's willing to leave her alone for a little bit and take off and take care of his own shit.
All right. I think I have one other topic to discuss, and then we'll wrap this up. Do you find it at all interesting that we're an episode removed, like episode 2, they made a big deal that we had Daenerys at a table strategizing with all women and Tyrion, and now all of those women are captive, soon to be dead, or are dead. Like, I don't know. Do you see? Is there anything to read into that meeting moving forward, or was it just one of those times where, like, it just made sense that all these people were there?
I think it just made sense that all these people were there. I think it was, you know, let's not get into my beliefs or discuss whatnot that don't affect Game of Thrones, but I think it was just the people noticing something, you know, which would have made sense in the context. I mean, you have the head of 3 of the states that are helping her, along with her, her number one advisor, and the Hand. So you can look and see into what it is, but all of her big advisors who were there were the people who would have been advising her. The same way, I mean, without seeing that Euron had been able to make a fleet of hundreds of warships in the time that they had been gone, their plans would have worked and probably spelled Cersei's doom, but he came in like a fucking berserk badass out of nowhere and threw the monkey wrench in that's causing her to have to seek allies rather than just go stomping a shithole into everybody like she was planning on doing when she just showed up.
If Euron can steal every episode moving forward, I say give that man a fucking Emmy, because he has single-handedly been the most entertaining character this season. I'm not saying captivating, I'm not saying important, I'm saying he's been by far the most entertaining character. Has he been the most entertaining character for you so far this season, three episodes in?
Oh yeah. I mean, him, I'm glad the Hound was back for what he was, because I mean, you know, calling a dude with a top knot a cunt is always pretty fucking funny for me. Yeah, Euron is definitely, he's a badass, which wasn't necessarily apparent from, you know, last season, the few episodes that he was in. He's funny, which is pretty fucking awesome. And like I said, I love his interactions with Jaime, how he just baits him in situations where Jaime can't respond.
Yeah, he's a maniacal prick that's just badass enough to back it up, and that makes him beyond entertaining to me. He keeps me entertained. With that being said, we are damn close to the hour and a half mark, so we're going to get off here. Do you have any final thoughts, any final predictions for next week, anything you want to say, get off your chest?
Before we go into that, what about the shit that we predicted last week, and what popped up and changed in this one? Obviously, like, who arrives first in Winterfell, we were wrong about Arya, so what else did we predict? Who was going to die?
Yeah, there was the five predictions at the end about death, and I really should have wrote them down, but I didn't. So that's something I will do. I'll listen to last week's, and I'll write it down as to what the predictions were, because I can't really remember off the top of my head. Obviously, my memory issues.
Okay, so next week we'll just go over the predictions for last week and this week.
Yeah, so let's take... Let's each make three predictions, just for the fun of it. That way I can review it, write it down, and see if we're right. So make three predictions for next week of something of interest that could happen.
Shit, all right. Danny's going to fly out on a dragon and not get shot, but she's not going to be as successful as she thinks she's going to be when she goes out. Somehow Tyrion is going to find out what they meant about Jon being stabbed in the heart, and we'll figure out what the allusion to that was in this episode. And Jaime and Cersei are going to have an argument over Elena and Euron.
All right. I'm going to predict... My first one's going to be Theon goes to save Yara and dies... hopefully at the hands of Euron. My second prediction is, just because I want to happen, we're going to see the Mountain kill somebody. And my third prediction... I don't have anything left that's very amusing to me, but let's go with... Jorah... We see Jorah, but he doesn't make it to Dragonstone. Like, he ends up... with another character that we are familiar with. I don't know who.
Jorah and Bronn.
Oh my god, dude. That'd be almost like a wet dream for me. In the weirdest of way. That sounded awful. I have no regrets. Seriously, like... I've often thought about this. I'm sure a lot of people have often thought about, like, who your top five favorite people are. And Jorah and Davos have long been up there... And as has Bronn, like, those guys have been up there along with, like, Tywin and the Hound, and I know I'm missing a few actual top-notch people, like Varys and Littlefinger, but yeah, that's basically, like, Jake eight of my car. 10. What?
The Faceless Man, Jake in a car.
Oh, Jockin, yeah. That dude. I love that dude, too.
Dude, we're making, like, a Game of Thrones Dirty Dozen.
We are, and I really am digging it. I'm trying to think who else. I know he was a dick, but apparently because I love Euron, I like dicks. But Stannis.
You said it.
Yep, I went on here. I said I like dicks.
What about Dolorous Ed from the Night's Watch? He's the one who's in charge now.
Oh, okay, yeah, totally liked him. Actually, I liked the guy who betrayed John because he reminded me a lot of Calm Meany. I don't know. I think it was his voice that I liked, but yeah, big fan of him. I know we aren't naming any chicks, and I kind of feel bad, and I'm not even sure who I'd start with a chick, but I've never once hated Gilly, so I may go with her first.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I was going to say, what about the wildling chick, whatever her name was? The one who got slipped by Ramsey.
Ygritte?
Not Ygritte, the one who was taking Bran and Rickon.
Oh, Mira?
Ramsey killed her. Yeah, whatever her name was. Yeah.
Mira, her.
Or, no, not Mira. Yeah, you know who I'm talking about.
Yes, she was awesome. Because she was with Rickon, yeah. Rickon. Yeah. Huh. She was always awesome, too. That's a really good call. Man. That's going to be something for us to do at some point, is probably next season when all is said and done, because it doesn't seem fair to make, like, a top list. And, I mean, we have another season left, and then it's done anyway, so it makes more sense to hold off. But, at the end of the season, I will be doing a top 10 characters of this season. That seems fair. Euron's already number one for me. It's going to be tough to top. Like, seriously, somebody has to up their game. Like, I don't even know. If the mountain rips off, like, 12 people's heads, he's in the conversation. There we go. All right. You know, we were going to talk about the invitation, and we are still here because that's coming out. In theory, that's going to be coming out tomorrow for the blog. I don't have any guarantees that it will be, but I'm going to try like hell. Actually, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to just ask you. I got to actually put up 4 films for a nomination. If you think about everything that's on Netflix right now and you could nominate one thing from Netflix, what would it be?
Well, the shitty thing is that Pontypool just got removed yesterday or the day before.
Oh my god. Really?
Yep. I had it on my phone to rewatch and they removed it. They said Netflix has lost the right to show this. So.
Oh my god. That was definitely on my top 4 that I was going to nominate. I was going to keep nominating it until it got picked. Ah.
Do you want something that people have seen or something that people haven't seen?
Something people haven't seen. Something not so popular because we're trying to force people to actually, you know, watch other things.
I'm drawing a blank on what they have on Netflix, right? I wish it was easier to look up by genre than it is by... than it is by how they have it separated.
I just recently watched The Void, and it was funny. I was talking to Eric a few days ago. He's like, I just saw something, I think it was like on IGN. He's like, they recommend this movie on Netflix called The Void. I'm like, yep, just watched it. And I don't want to recommend it because the first hour is really good, and the last half hour of it really kind of hurts your brain to watch it. But, like, if you can handle just watching half a movie, watch The Void. But I can't recommend that. I'm trying to think what else. We just watched XX. Okay,
you're looking for one or for 4?
Just looking for one. One that you would consider nominating because really don't know.
Since I know you like it, they've got Dead Silence on there. So.
Ooh. Yes. Dead Silence. Yo. That movie got shit on so much because it was from the makers of Saw, so everybody thought it was going to be like Saw, and it had no real elements of Saw aside from Billy the Puppet there. And it was a really, I don't know, I thought it was a really well done story.
It had one of the best beginnings I'd seen in a horror movie, and it had an ending that fizzled. The middle parts were pretty good, but...
Regarding the ending, since I don't want to go into spoilers, are you referring to the big reveal at the end?
Not only the big reveal, but just how it ended. You know, it kind of, it was almost like a flashback to 80s horror movies in the way that it ended, if you know what I'm saying.
I do. I 100% know what you're talking about. Yeah, makes sense. So, yeah, Dead Silence You see, you got to name one of the four movies that I'm nominating tomorrow. I don't know what the other ones are. I'm so pissed off about Pontypool right now. I want to punch something.
I mean, there's a bunch of foreign movies on there still that I can't remember. Like a couple of the ones that I was talking to you back when you asked about foreign movies on the Babadook blog.
Oh, yeah.
That are still on there. That I think
Train to Busan's still on, right?
Train to Busan's still on. The one I saw, there's a, I can't remember what the hell the name of it was, but it's a Iranian horror movie that takes place during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, about an Iranian female doctor. That's still on there. I forgot what it was called. It was pretty good. You know what I would really like to see get discussed? There was this Korean horror movie called The Wailing, and a lot of lists put it on the best horror movie of 2016. And yep. I watched it, and I thought it was a good movie, but I didn't think it was scary at all. And my big question is whether or not it's because of the lack of me not being really totally familiar with Korean culture compared to, you know, somebody who grew up in that culture. I could definitely see, though, like, for foreign movies being translated into modern movies, if they took it, made it thematically specific for being over in a Western audience, I could see that being a scary movie. The Host is, I think, is on there still, and that was one you were talking about never having seen too, so that was pretty good.
I haven't seen that. Now, The Wailing, is that one that takes place like in like a school of sorts?
It takes place in like almost like a mountain village in Korea, and you can look up the trailer. I mean, if you, it wasn't a bad movie, but a lot of people were putting it at number one for horror movies for 2016, and I saw it, and I'm like, maybe it's just the lack of the culture difference that's causing me not to see this as being scary compared to somebody growing up there and seeing, okay, yeah, this is scary as shit.
See, I'm thinking I may have actually seen the movie.
There's a Japanese guy living in a forest. The main character's a cop. His daughter gets possessed. All sorts of shit goes on from there.
I may not have seen it. I may be thinking of something else then, because the one I'm thinking of took place in a school. It was on Netflix, though, and it had a lot of good reviews, but it wasn't horror in the least bit. So when you kind of was talking about that, that was the first thing I was thinking of, was that particular film. But now I really don't know. I'd have to get back to you on that. That intrigues me.
One of the things that I would like to see from our votes going forward is, instead of like what happens when you give it to us, we have a lot of movies in a similar vein. I'd like to see like almost like four different types of horror movies being nominated, rather than just, you know, like creature feature, or slasher fic kind of shit.
I would also like that. My problem is that I don't want to tell people, hey, this guy already nominated this, so you got to stay away from it. I hope that people take it upon themselves to just be like, all right, this has already been done. I don't want to see three people nominate a zombie flick. That would just be boring. I agree with you. I want as much diversity in films as possible, and horror has, I don't even know, countless number of subgenres, so there really is no excuse for it to happen, but it does happen nonetheless. It sucks, but I don't really know what else to do about it. God damn it, my blog is not very easy to search for a lot of stuff, I don't feel. Let me try. There is a search bar up top. I wonder if it works. I had all this shit working tip-top, and then a lot of stuff got changed on me, and I don't know if it's for the better or for the worst. I'm going to say the worst. Fantastic. All right, I won't say I never saw The Wailing, but I did see Dumpling, or Dumplings, whatever the hell it was. That was okay. I don't know if you saw it.
No, I have not.
It was fine. I don't have any complaints about it whatsoever. I'm trying to think what else in Korean. I kind of want to go back. I know this October, that's the thing, like, I'm gearing up for everything in October. I'm going to go back and watch a lot of the stuff that started in Japan but got Americanized. So The Ring, Ju-on, was it Pulse or Shudder, something like that? Shudder. Yeah. The Eye, I'm trying to think. There's probably a couple more that I'm just forgetting or didn't even realize originally started in Japan. I kind of want to watch them because I haven't watched hardly any of those. I saw the original The Eye long before I saw the, was it Jessica Alba one? I liked it, so I never actually saw the Americanized version, as a matter of fact. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. I definitely gotta pick some stuff. I gotta look tonight. Maybe next week we can talk about the invitation. I don't know, I kind of actually want to talk more about the invitation than We Are Still Here, just because We Are Still Here feels like a more traditional horror film, versus The Invitation was really, an interesting take on the horror genre, I felt.
My biggest question for We Are Still Here would just be, and I think it's going to be almost open-ended for anybody, is just, you know, what is your take on the very ending compared to, The Invitation was something different. Both of them were very good examples of horror movies coming out different genres in the same year, and I think they both did a very good job. But yeah, The Invitation was something I wasn't necessarily expecting. Well, I mean, I didn't see We Are Still Here until all the buzz from it had been out, so I had a little more idea of what was going to happen going into it, and I really liked both of them, but I could see where you're coming from.
We Are Still Here, well, it was awesome. As a matter of fact, I may actually like that movie better than The Invitation, but it was more of a traditional horror movie. That's all I'm saying. I don't know. The Invitation, honestly, there for a significant amount of time, I was really believing that the dude was kind of crazy, because I don't know if I'd just seen it or if I saw it right afterwards, but there was another movie that I saw where it was the exact opposite of how The Invitation played out. Shit. It's still on Netflix. I'm pulling up Netflix right now, so give me a moment here. But do you want to comment on whether you actually thought he was crazy or sane?
One of the things that I liked about it was the fact that they you kept getting hints. I mean, and the shit was creepy as fuck. You know, that something's wrong. And then they alleviate your suspicions. You know, he gets that text from, what's his face? You know, hey, where the hell is he? You know, he's supposed to be here before we get. And then the dude shows up, and you're like, oh, he's fucking crazy. And then, you know, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, after they've been building up tension for 3/4 of the movie, shit gets real. So,
okay, I think the name of the thing, here it is. They Look Like People. Have you ever seen it or heard of it?
I've heard of it because you were bringing it up the, I want to say the very first week we were talking about doing the blog, maybe.
Oh, yeah, it's a very interesting, well done, and had to have been cheap as hell to make. It's really well done, and it has that same vibe as The Invitation. So if you like The Invitation, and you don't mind a little bit more talky-talky and less action, if you don't mind that, then They Look Like People is a really good one. And I mean, really, see, I saw then, I also saw Darling around the same time, and that's another one that's more talky than action, but it's cool. I really like it, and that's still on Netflix. So that, I don't know, maybe I'm starting to make myself a little list here. I also see American Werewolf in London's on there, but I'm not going to nominate it as much as I love it. Oh, and there's also a movie called Clown. Have you ever seen Clown?
I have seen Clown.
The dad's name is Kent, so that's why I watched it, and I was happy. I don't have very good reasons for doing a lot of things, but I feel that was a legit reason to do it. Housebound's still on there. Tales of Halloween, The Shrine, Would You Rather, Hush, although I found Hush to be wildly overrated.
It's sad when a good movie gets so much hype that when you see it, it just can't live up to the expectations that you set for it. I really wish that one of the fucking streaming services would get Lights Out, because I really like that from last year.
I have yet to see Lights Out, and that's something that I'm going to do in October.
It was one of the ones where it defied some of the tropes in that, like, people weren't necessarily just fucking stupid, like, every fucking moment that they possibly could be, which is one of the things I liked about it.
Two things I'm seeing, actually I'm seeing quite a few, but Ravenous. Did you ever see Ravenous?
Oh yeah, Ravenous. Ravenous would be a good one. Like you said, American Werewolf in London is another classic that hasn't been talked about yet, so.
Yeah, there's a movie called Extraordinary Tales, which is an animated take on five Edgar Allan Poe classics, and it's narrated by some, like, the coolest dudes to narrate shit. Highly recommend it if you like Edgar Allan Poe, which I think most people do. They may not know it, but they do. Haunter with Abigail Breslin. Really like that. That's almost like the horror version of Groundhog Day. Thought that was well done. Thing is, Netflix has a lot of good horror movies. It's just that I've seen almost all of their good horror movies. Like The Den. I thought that was actually a good movie. Good. Did you ever see What We Become?
Who was in that?
I think it was a Australian zombie type movie. Nobody that famous that I know of.
That looks no. I wanted to, but I haven't seen it now.
All right. It's it had good reviews and stuff. I didn't think it was that good. As I'm looking, though, there's another movie. It's only an hour and 15 minutes. It's called Bloody April Fools on Netflix. Actually, I reviewed it, and the people who made it saw my review and liked it on Facebook and on Twitter, and actually used a quote of mine for on their Facebook, I think, to, like, hype it up. It's like a cliched slasher movie, but sometimes there's nothing wrong with cliched slasher movies that hit all the marks. Man, there's a lot of things. I've seen so many of them. Anyway, I'll figure something out. Do you have any other things you want to talk about before we wrap this up?
Have you seen Stakeland or Stakeland 2?
Saw Stakeland 1, and then I saw Stakeland 2 was on Sci-Fi, and that concerned me a little bit, but I want to see it because I liked Stakeland 1 a lot.
I just watched it yesterday. It was pretty good. I mean, all the, well, the few living remaining characters were still there, so.
Okay, so it was a good continuation. It wasn't some random bullshit continuation.
Yeah, it wasn't just like, oh, Stakeland was a decent movie, we'll just use the name kind of shit.
Okay, that was my biggest concern. I know one that I'm going to recommend. Nobody's going to vote for it, but The House at the End of Time. It's not so much a horror movie, but it is a really amazingly well-done horror movie, in my opinion. Like, in a creepy genre. Not horror, but creepy genre, I guess.
Okay, well, maybe I'll vote for it for you.
Much obliged. I'm looking at The Wailing. I don't know. Maybe I did see it. God damn it. See, having shit from memory is really awesome. Last Shift, there's another one. Although it wasn't that great at the end, it actually had a lot of cool things to it. Huh. I hope we do the horror blog for a few years so we can get through some of the good horror that nobody's ever seen. That's my hope. By 2020, if we fizzle out, I'll be fine with it. But until then, I hope we have some good ones. Alright. Yeah, we're going to wrap this up because we're almost at the 2-hour mark now. So, next week we'll be back. Probably the podcast will hopefully be up maybe Thursday if we can work it in your schedule between that. We'll figure that out. But we'll have the blog up by Thursday this week. The podcast will be up. Obviously, you'll be hearing it. We'll continue to have the blog up on Thursdays at 9deuce.com. The podcasts are on 9deuce.com. They're available on iTunes. They're available. The podcast is available quite a few places. So any place you get your podcast, just look for Are You Not Kentertained? For Chris, this is Kat, and we say sniff you jerks later. Thank you.